They said I'm fine to start. So how are you doing, Ken?
I'm doing fine.
Good. So here was my thought for today, that we do maybe four things in, within this hour. One would be to do a brief bio, since I don't think in any of these other tapes we really did that.
Okay.
Second, as part of that, maybe we could just talk about what you did for AIW.
Okay.
And then thirdly, as I mentioned, it isn't part of our AIW project, but I'm real interested in the Wisconsin Labor History Society, partly because of my involvement in the Michigan one years ago. But also I'm hoping, I don't know what you and Elsula, when we were in Detroit, had some chance. I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm still hopeful that maybe there can be some cross-fertilization between Wisconsin, Illinois, and the Michigan one. And then the fourth one, and very important, is just to summarize what topics we're going to cover in the future interviews, and if either of us have any particular order we would prefer. And in what I emailed you and you responded, I outlined, I think, the second paragraph, some thoughts I had about what order we might go, or what we might cover.
Yeah, and that's pretty much, I did email you back, but you may not have gotten it because I didn't get to my emails until this morning. I pretty much outlined the same thing. So let's go.
Sounds good. And did you find what I had said was this thing we had worked on called The Allied Industrial Workers, The Untold Story, that was 5 pages long, the 5th page being resources consulted?
I didn't find it right now. But I do have it.
Yes. Okay. Because I could end there, but that's the one that kind of outlined it, and basically chronological, but somewhat put it into topics that I thought we could do. That was kind of my thought of what we would do this fall.
Yes, that's what I would think. And,
okay. Great. Well, we got that one pretty much already set. And before we do another one with your bio, I found, but I didn't listen to in detail, the interview that was done by Gordon, Professor Gordon,
right,
with you. But somehow I think it'll be nice if at some point I'll figure out how the Voice Library here would have that as an additional bio resource about you to supplement what we're going to cover.
Okay. Well, it is available in transcript form.
Uh-huh. Is it available in audio form?
They have it in cassettes only at this stage.
Cassette would be just fine. We'll just need to figure out how I can get a copy from you.
Well, I've got a copy, and they've got a copy up at the UWM library.
If it's not too much of a problem, could I get you some money and you could just get me a copy made of the cassette?
Well, you don't need to give me any money. I've been kind of wanted to digitize it anyway. I may do that. Otherwise, I will just make copies of the cassettes.
Or you could send it here and I could see about our digitizing it.
Sure. Okay. Very good.
Okay. So while we're on it, I'm just going to stick to it, because we are kind of doing the future interview. So in our outline, we talked about the creation of the UAW-AFL and then its relationship to the UAW-CIO. And some of that's been written about. I think I mentioned to you that at the North American Labor History Conference that we were both at, that I thought went pretty well, that I did talk to historian Nelson Lichtenstein from California.
Right.
And I told him the idea that you and I were working on this project on the other UAW. He smiled and said, that sounds interesting. He was positive. And then I said a couple things, such as I'm about to chat with you about, that we might cover. And he was positive about all of those making sense. And then I specifically said, how did he think about anyone re-looking at Homer Martin and not just telling the story of Homer Martin being a fool or Homer Martin, you know, the different relatively negative ways.
Right.
And trying to explain better why did some of the people that you've interviewed and I interviewed who are decent trade unionists decide to go with that guy. And Lichtenstein thought that sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
So
I think the early founding of the union, which, you know, really was the foundation of the UAW, both CIO and the AFL, I think is an interesting story. It's the earliest, bit of history, and so I would think that one topic would be the founding of the UAW AFL up to the time of the split of 1939. I think the next topic would be the actual split and the justification for it or not. And so that would be the second topic.
Uh-huh.
Then I think we would probably get into how this tiny segment of the UAW survived up to the, and maybe into the corruption thing.
Uh-huh.
And then whether or not we would combine the corruption, the reform with in that segment or make it a separate segment, we could decide later.
Mm-hmm.
And that would get us, and then we get to the revitalization of the AIW and its innovations that came out of a small union and justified its existence. And then the ending pressures of deindustrialization and everything else that went on with all unions beginning in the 80s or so.
Uh-huh.
That would be my outline. I would suggest we do it chronological. And
great.
Prior to that meeting, that first time we get together, I'll review my notes and tapes from both, well, mainly Gabe Jewell, and, read over my other resources.
Okay.
And then we'll go into the split. We might do that on one phone call, or we could do the split on the second phone call. We'll see how the first one goes.
That sounds very good, so I'll spend some time listening to some of the tapes that I've done before, and also look at some of the historical books and such, talking about things like Lichtenstein's, talking about the split from the UAW-CIO's point of view, and then a couple of the really old labor histories like the Taft and some of those old guys that used to be called institutionalists, they got into AFL versus CIO, and here and there are little references to AIW, and I'll look for those.
Yeah, good. I mean, there was a historic UAW convention here in Milwaukee in 1937, where the split was temporarily healed with John L. Lewis here. And that was a very historic event. And so anyway, there's a lot of history there.
When was that historic convention?
In 1937, in the summer at the old Schrader Hotel.
Okay. I have from several of the regional directors in Michigan old proceedings of the UAW-AFL or AIW, and then some AFL convention proceedings. And I'll look to see if I have something from that time period. Mostly I have...
Yeah, they will be available in the archives.
Right.
At Pittsburgh.
But
and, And I used to have, I wish the hell I'd taken all of them out of the office.
Because
they had it, we had them all, you know.
Go ahead. I'm jotting down to add we need to talk about Pittsburgh, too, so if we get to it. When you were listing the topics, the sort of fifth one that I got to count, but doesn't matter what number, when we were talking about innovations, what were you mainly thinking about?
Well, I was thinking about, getting into the occupational and safety health. We were one of the early unions that got some grants and really focused in. We were particularly strong in the grain industry. I think we even, because we had a lot of grain mills, particularly in central Illinois. And we were very good in Milan Rasek, who's still around here in town, he was our safety and health director, and I'm sure he'd love to talk about it.
Okay, that's a possibility to follow up.
So those are two things. Oh, plus the coordinated bargaining.
That's what I also wondered about.
Yeah, we were very, I think we were very active in that, even though we were sometimes one of the smaller unions. And really fostered that. And that, sadly, kind of failed. There were successes and failures. But it's an area that that has a lot of interesting sidelights.
Sounds good. So I think we'll proceed in chronological order in our other sessions. And we'll look at those. You got sort of six that you just said, or I heard them as six, okay. So that's good.
Go ahead.
It's fine. Since we just mentioned it, and I'm otherwise going to forget it, what do you see as kind of where we're at in terms of Pittsburgh and what the steelworkers have of the pace?
Well, they will eventually go to Penn State. And they are at the steel worker headquarters right now, and the guy said that as far as he can be determined, we'd be welcome to use them while they're still in Pittsburgh. That'll be probably to the middle of the year of 2016.
Okay.
And then they're going to be transferred.
I had been following that discussion, and of course I had discussion with John Lepley, I think is how you say his name?
That's his name, yeah.
And I didn't get involved in following up with your last comments to him because I wasn't clear on how long they were going to be there. And
well, that isn't for certain. He's guessing to about the middle of the year.
Okay.
But perhaps the sooner we got over there, the better. I'm not so eager to make the trip, but we can talk about that.
But if I drove, you'd be willing.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going to be next year, to be honest with you.
Well, sure.
And so what I'd like to do would be just to defer that. I mean, if nothing else, you could go there. I mean, you're the researcher. I'm just I'm the BS guy. So.
Well, I wouldn't call you the BS guy, but I'll tentatively think in my own mind that this is maybe something in spring that we could go to Pittsburgh for.
Sure.
And not before then.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, working my way backwards through this, do you want to talk about the Labor History Society next, or you want to do a brief bio about yourself and your AIW jobs?
Well, why don't we just briefly stay with the, I'll do the Labor History Society.
Great.
And I'll just and I'm not sure just exactly what you want to know, but I will tell you this, and you can, I'll give you a brief history of the society and how it has been established, what its general format is, and what our prospects look like, if that makes sense. It was founded in 1981 by a combination of labor historians at the University of Wisconsin and the State Historical Society, along with some local union activists and the state AFL-CIO. We had a staff person at the state AFL-CIO by the name of Daryl Holter. And Daryl had his PhD, but he was in charge of the education department or something at the state Fed. I'm not exactly sure. But anyway, he was kind of the power behind it, and so they got together and got a state charter from the Secretary of State and nonprofit status, and started. And almost from the beginning, there's been a conscious effort. We affiliated at the start with the State Historical Society. So we're a member of the Council of Local History Societies. In other words, we're in with people like the Bayview Historical Society, Milwaukee County Historical Society, the Knox Creek Historical Society in Northwest Wisconsin, and all of those local societies.
Are you the only one that isn't a location and instead is a topic or a theme?
No. There's the Wisconsin Cemeteries Association and a whole bunch of other groups.
Okay.
They have quite a nice local council setting, and every year they go and hold regional conferences. One of the historical societies in the area, like in Northwest Wisconsin, the Gordon Washcott Historical Society, where my wife was born, they will host the party, the group, and then the state will come in and give a one-day training, and the local group will provide the lunch and so forth.
Okay.
So it's that way. It's kind of an interesting way because it does offer an opportunity for us to get labor history, interest in the local history societies.
Yeah, it sounds...
Many of which just want to preserve old houses,
Right.
And we are able to point out that history is a lot more than old houses, that it's the people who lived in those houses.
Right.
And they weren't necessarily mansions, So that area, so...
Did that just happen? That you went that route? Because Illinois wasn't done that way, correct?
I don't know how they were done. Les O'Rear started that back about the same time, maybe 2 years before ours.
Mm-hmm.
I think we got some inspiration from theirs as well.
We did, in Michigan.
Yeah, to get ours started. I don't know that for sure. I'd have to ask.
But
I was not on the founding group.
You were not? Okay. When did you start being involved?
Well, not until, I was a member for a long time, but I never took part in any activities. I maybe went to one or two conferences, and I hosted a panel one time. I did a tour with Frank Zeidler, our former mayor, of work sites. And, I did some stuff, but I was very busy with my international union. So I was not active until 1991.
Okay. Is that when you retired?
I retired in 92.
Okay. So you got active in 91 as a leadership kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah. They asked me to, that time, actually I think that was 91. Yeah, because what happened was that George Statesman, who was the education director at the AIW, had agreed to become the next president. Whoever was president, I think it was Darryl, had moved out to Los Angeles. And so I think he quit, and they asked George to be the president of the Historical Society. And George and I were very tight friends. And he passed away in October of 1991 of a sudden heart attack. He was listening, ironically, to the Justice Thomas and Anita Hill hearings.
Wow.
And I think the bullshit got it. You know? But that's so he asked me to take over for him, and since I knew my days at the AIW at that time were numbered, I agreed. So I became president in 92 at the 92 conference in April, and then went on to stay there as president until 2009, when I became emeritus. So at that point, I've actually been acting as like the executive director of the organization.
Right.
You know, even while I was president and so forth, doing all of the, you know, day-to-day activities and so forth. This is with some fairly good volunteer help, so I don't want to, knock that, but they do, such societies need somebody
yep.
to be hands-on, and I'm pretty much that guy. So
you were president for 17 years.
17 years.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I guess it would be 2009. Yeah.
Did you always do the one-day conference in the spring?
Yeah, that's part of our constitution.
Uh-huh.
Or our bylaws. And we have to follow bylaws created by the State Historical Society.
Oh.
And then, of course, we're able to make our own little modifications within certain very general guidelines. They're not dictatorial about it, but, you know, it does provide some institutionalization, which is good for all of these societies.
Well, I would think, as you mentioned earlier, that it really, that connection with the State History Society, especially such a good one as Wisconsin has, it's well known nationally, gives a lot of legitimacy for you going to these little community history groups and saying maybe you want to do something about workers or a factory or a union.
Well, right, and as a matter of fact, we put on our letterhead at the bottom, affiliated with the Wisconsin State Historical Society. You know?
Uh-huh.
Or it's the Wisconsin Historical Society is the formal title now. But
how many members do you have now? How many was it the largest? How many was it in the early years of your leadership? I mean, did it sort of stay constant or change? Or?
Well, actually, I can't speak for the time before 1992.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, when I took over in 92, we had about 100-plus individual members, perhaps 50. We have two general types of memberships, one for individuals and one for organizations, which are basically local unions and labor councils. And we had 100 individuals approximately, and about 50 organizations. We now have about 220 paying members, individuals, and over 75 local unions and organizations. And last year we reached our peak. Even we've seen largely with the decimation of the Wisconsin labor movement, thanks to Act 10 and now Right to Work coming in, you know, nonetheless, we've seen renewed interest in our work, and I attribute that a lot to the active members of our labor unions becoming far more alert to doing things to revitalize the labor movement. They see history as one of those tools. So we've actually, we're actually very well recognized within the labor movement itself. And that's part of the strategy that we came up with early on, and we tried to follow as we create a board of directors. We've always tried to maintain a balance of about half academics and half, working unionists or retired unionists. In other words, we want people off the shop floor as well as renowned PhDs like Steve Meyer and Will Jones and a bunch of those people have been and are on our board right now. So they bring that prestige while we bring credibility within the labor movement by having local union people on it. And these are people with an interest, of course. And out of that, the other part of that that is important is that from the beginning, we've had excellent support from the state AFL-CIO. They've given us logistical support, which has really helped. They give us a part of an office where we keep all our stuff and where I work. I go for several hours a week and, do all of the day-to-day stuff with our mail, and even provide some secretarial help, which is really, helpful. Plus the use of their office machines, high-speed copiers and mailing equipment.
It's very useful, very helpful.
Yeah.
Do you have much?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Do you have you had much interaction during your years of being the president and emeritus with other labor history societies or labor history organizations around the country or not?
Well, we do with the American Labor Studies Center in New York, Paul Cole.
Right.
Paul's actually a graduate of Marquette University here in Milwaukee, so he's got those ties. And one thing that has helped is that the current retired state AFL-CIO president is David Newby. Now, David's got his master's degree. I'm not exactly sure what he was in, but he came in through the Teaching Assistants Union efforts in organizing in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And became eventually secretary treasurer of the state Fed and then its president. And, Dave is a very articulate, intelligent, and academic-type guy who was able to nonetheless win over all of us hardheads and hardhats.
Right.
It was not the labor movement, So... he was a very strong supporter, as are the current officers.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been invaluable. I mean, I think we do a great service to the Wisconsin labor movement by providing that kind of foundation and stuff that,
But no active programming or exchange of things with the Illinois Labor History Society?
Well, through the years, when Bill Adelman was still alive, he came up and did a presentation on Haymarket, when we held our conference in Bayview, actually. And so that worked out good, and And I've had a long personal friendship with the late Les O'Rear, and we've had informal things. Now we are getting together Saturday morning with the executive director of the Illinois Labor History Society and perhaps a couple of her board members, along with our president Steve DeCarrier and one of our founding members, Joanne Rica, and myself, to talk about some sort of a collaboration. And we have no idea where that'll go, if it'll go anywhere. But we are eager in pursuing. I kept all the material that the Michigan Labor History Society put in our kits in the Detroit conference. So I'm going to show that, and we were only able to talk for like 30 seconds there, because they didn't see him until I was starting my speech, I guess.
Right.
So, and then I had to leave right away. So, it appears you guys are interested in some collaboration, some way, somehow, down the road, and I'll certainly mention that Saturday and see if there's any ideas.
Absolutely, and both Elsel and I were involved in the Michigan one being created in the winter of 76-77, and part of the way that was done was having Bill Adelman come over to the Corn Blues House in Ann Arbor and give a presentation, probably on Haymarket, but on one of his stories, one of his slideshows at the time, that later became a booklet, and what they were just starting to do with the Illinois Labor History Society, and it was the following year that the Michigan one was created. So,
yeah, you guys predate us, and, you know, I was over there in Detroit for something, whether it was a Labor Press Association conference or what, I don't recall anymore, and I did that tour, you know, your labor history tour, and Dave was, I'm sure, involved in that at that time, and, but that's, you know, my God, that's 40 years ago, or 35 years ago at least, I'm sure.
We did that separate from the society, but often in conjunction, but that would have been sometime after 78 and could have been any time into the 80s or even into the early 90s. So,
yeah, well, this would have been probably earlier on.
But that's exactly the kind of group we would do it for. But I think that possibility is still there. Unfortunately, the Michigan one has never had that kind of connection with the state history society or other explicit groups. There were times where the Reuther Archives played an important role, or the UAW would provide some space, staff, or other kinds of things. But nothing as interesting as what you just described. So that's pretty fascinating.
Were you able, when you were here for that Milwaukee History Conference, look at the Zeidler Union Square stuff we have there?
I attended your conference that day.
And you would have almost walked by it.
I think I did, but I can't recall what it is you're referring to exactly.
Well, there's a city park that's a block square right there behind Grand Avenue and between 4th and 3rd Streets and Michigan and St. Paul.
Okay.
Well, actually, Everett Street. But in that park is a gazebo with all sorts of worker artifacts in it. And then there's a bollards with chains on it and sayings, various labor sayings.
Yeah, I think I do know now.
And then there was plaques, 21 plaques, I believe, on those bollards that cite certain labor history events in the city or the state, I guess. And well, they're more than just labor history, but more like worker history.
Right.
And so that's, we were the fiscal agent for the funds that over $200,000 were spent to get that thing created. And so that was a project of the Labor History Society. Now there's a separate organization maintaining it through the local labor council. But now it's becoming, and it needs some refurbation.
Yeah. Well, right now, ELSL has been trying to raise money. I don't know when you're next going to get to Detroit, but you did get to see the DIA this time.
Yeah.
But another time, there is a very interesting labor art project on the foot of the river in Woodward Avenue in Jefferson that one of those brochures you have talks about the Labor Legacy Project.
Oh, is that the one with the big hoop or whatever it was? I can't remember.
Yeah, and it has a lot of statements from labor leaders and civil rights people out of history talking about Detroit and broader stories. And that's downtown right at the foot of Woodward and Jefferson on the river.
And yeah, I mean, both cities, Detroit and Milwaukee, I mean, were industrial, blue-collar. They were built by the workers in these cities. I mean, their whole economies. I mean, our city was a very dowdy community back when I was a kid and a young man. But everybody had a goddamn job, well, except during the Depression, of course. And they were all making, you know, fairly good wages for the kind of work you were getting. So it was a great place to. We had a great school system. Everything was, you know, fucking great. But that's all changed, of course. Anyway,
before we get off of this, one of the things I'd hope you talk about would be about the Bayview story and the video and the conferences you've done related to Bayview.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of a fascinating thing that you've done, and you mentioned that you had Edelman up when you were doing a Bayview event.
Well, right. We do, the Labor History Society sponsors and has since 1986, for the last 29 years, an annual event in honor of what we would call the Bayview tragedy, but which is probably more accurately called the Bayview Massacre. That honors the seven who were shot by the state militia here on May 5th of 1886 at an eight-hour day rally. And ironically, that came less than 24 hours after the Haymarket event the previous night in Chicago, and was partially the Haymarket event was partially responsible for the reaction, we think, of the authorities in shooting down the marchers. They were marching towards the largest plant in Milwaukee at that time.
Which plant?
Well, it was the Bayview Rolling Mills. It no longer exists. It was on the lakefront, and it had close to 2,000 workers in it in 1886. And it made, among other things, its principal product was iron rails for the railroads. And it was a natural site for it because lake boats would bring in coal and ore to do their molding and so forth. So event. We killed just one or two people fewer than the Haymarket thing. Yet nobody in the world knows about it except us, since we started promoting it in 1986. So we hold that event, and we now get 300 to 400 people for an outdoor event on a cold Sunday in May every year. So we're in the midst of planning it for 2016. which would be the 30th. Oh, my God, it's the 30th. I mean, the 130th anniversary.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we will be doing that again. We've got several videos of it. We put together with a grant from the Humanities Council a study guide about it, and so forth.
Have you gotten that in? I have one of the videos. Does anyone use that, like in any kind of schooling or any kind of programming?
No, we haven't been able to get it to be used, unfortunately. I ironically did a couple classes over at Bayview High School here just a week or so ago.
Huh.
And, I mean, these are inner city kids, and I mean, you know, they weren't ready to sit for something like that, so I had to simplify my presentations.
Uh-huh.
I won't go into that, but I mean, we haven't had it used like it should be.
Uh-huh. But if you're...
That's a failure probably of not promoting it, and that's because of lack of time.
But if you had 300 to 400 people show up at an annual event on a outdoor event in May, that's pretty significant, don't you think?
Oh, we think so. We think so, and people look forward to it, and then, so right now I mentioned the Bayview tragedy in Milwaukee, and people know exactly what I'm talking about, even people who have no particular interest in labor, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I think we've succeeded in you know, some awareness in that area. Well, listen, we only got about 15 minutes left. Do you want to get through the bio, or have you had enough, or do you want more on the labor?
I've never had enough talking with you, but are there other key stories about the Labor History Society? This has been very helpful. I will pass.
Well, we also have a Labor in the Schools project.
Uh-huh.
And we seek extra donations from local labor unions and labor councils for that. That's outside of our dues. Our dues basically pays for our entire operation. So our dues are $20 a year for an individual, $50 for smaller local unions under 500, and $100 a year for the larger groups.
Okay.
And so we get about $26,000 a year. I have to verify that, but in dues alone, maybe a little more. So monetarily, we've got enough to operate on under the current structure as long as the membership. Mm-hmm. We raise around $3,000 or more in this special Labor in the Schools Fund. And we use that to provide cash prizes for a labor history essay contest, which is open to high school students throughout the state. And we get about 50 entries a year. Kids don't like to write much anymore.
You're funny.
So we give cash prizes of $500 for the first prize, a few down to $100. And then that if we award all the prizes we set aside, that's $1,500 in cash prizes. We award about $1,000 because we cooperate with this Wisconsin Historical Society in the National History Day program. Do you guys have that in Michigan?
There is a major program by the Historical Society of Michigan that has school kids doing various activities. And
that's exactly what it is.
And there's a day given where there's judges. People like myself get asked to be judges at this event. And for a few years when I was on the board of the Historical Society, we got some unions to be involved, and they created a labor theme as one of dozens of themes. But I don't know if anybody's keeping that going, and I don't know of anything separately done by the Michigan Labor History Society. If ELSL has done that, I don't know that.
Yeah, well, we have done that very actively, and that's done largely by our volunteers. One of our board members takes over the chairmanship of that project. There are seven, or I think this year there's going to be eight regional conferences. So we give $50 awards to both the junior and the senior. There's a middle school level and a high school level.
Gotcha.
And they have regional conferences, and they have a state conference in Madison. So it encourages kids to do, videos, poster projects, all sorts of things. And it gets them thinking about, if they have a labor theme, and the best one with a labor theme in each region, will get the kids who put it together will get a cash award. It's just a token cash, but it's something. But we work very closely with the State Historical Society, who is, puts that on. And it's become a bigger event. I think we get more kids involved with that than we do in our essay contest.
Cool. So,
and then we also have a separate fund called the Legacy Fund, which we seek $15 a year from 100 people to provide cash awards, again, for academic papers, undergraduate paper on Wisconsin labor history that wins will get $500. A graduate paper will get $1,000. That's generated some more active interest in doing academic projects on labor history. In fact, Adam Mertz, or March, was at the Detroit conference.
Uh-huh.
He's at the University of Illinois Chicago now, and he was one of our winners.
Cool.
So he was at our conference in Detroit, actually. So we've had a couple of books come out of those projects, when I think of it, our society has done some pretty neat stuff.
I'm impressed. I mean, and I'm familiar with what's been done in some other states, and I think what you've done is very impressive.
Well, we really are more grassroots, I think, than a lot of, and I think that's done by our policy of getting local union people on the board and everything else like that. We just buried one of our longtime active members. He was out of a printing union up in Appleton, and he was big bluff. He spoke in one word sentences almost, but he could con $20 out of you, if he came up wanting a donation for Cope or something, you gave it to him,
Yep.
And he was so active in the schools in the Fox River Valley area in getting them involved, because he was on the school board there, and, those kind of guys I think our membership in that area is going to drop 50% with this passing, unfortunately, because people like that are irreplaceable. So you got to have both. You got to have real working unionists, and you got to have the academics.
Instead of going and doing a brief bio, I guess I'd like you just to stay on this topic and more like, why and how had got you into putting so much energy into labor history, activity, and preservation? How would you summarize all of what you've been telling me? How and why do you do it?
Well, I don't know. My wife wants to know, too.
Why don't you just retire? Is that the way she phrases it?
Yeah, let's pass that off for a minute. I don't know why, to be honest with you, except that I've always been interested in history from the time I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was fascinated by Franklin D. Roosevelt, and actually people in my generation. I was born in 1929, so I know the effects of the Great Depression. I know the issues. We followed World War II as kids, you know, very astutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because of very selfish reasons. First of all, you know, I had an uncle to whom he had lived with us until he had to go into the army in 1940, and he helped raise me. And, of course, he was in harm's way all during the war. If the war had gone on a year or two more, I would have been drafted into World War II. As it was, I was too young. And so we were very interested in you know, what went on for very personal reasons. You know, the rationing that went on and everything else that affected your day-to-day activities. When you ask the girl out on a date, I mean, I used to go on dates with one girl on our streetcars, you know. So, you can't neck very well on a streetcar.
No, I don't think so.
So you were basically interested for selfish reasons.
Uh-huh.
And then I was just interested. History was one of my favorite topics in high school.
Uh-huh.
So that was why I was interested. And even though my dad, by the time he had worked in the cannery, he came up from the grubbiest jobs in the hide house to eventually being a white-collar worker. At the time, the Fur and Leather Workers organized his cannery.
What city?
Here in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And he was by then on the white collar side, and so they had a very nasty strike at his place in 34, 35. And so, but he was never a management type guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I just became a fan of I was on the side of the unions all the time. Don't ask me why. I followed the Taft-Hartley debates before that bill was passed. So I just became fascinated by unions. And then when I got out of the service, I went to work for the Milwaukee Sentinel and was active in the newspaper guild and saw the good that we did for our members. And
active as a steward, or?
Well, yeah, I was. I came on as a reporter rewrite man, and then eventually became a rewrite person, which was I was headed on the management track, actually, believe it or not. And and they asked me to be steward of the newsroom, and I said I don't know a goddamn thing about it, but. You know, they talk you into it. And then they elected me to the executive board, and I was on the bargaining committee. And then we went on strike in 1962, and I became chairman of the strike committee. And that meant running the day-to-day details of a strike where we had a 24/7 picket line. And, and we were out for 10 weeks. And so then at the end of this, the strike was ended when the Milwaukee Sentinel was sold to the Milwaukee Journal Company. And the journal company hired everybody out of the newsroom to put out their edition of the Morning Sentinel, with the exception of about a dozen of us. And those that weren't hired were either alcoholics or otherwise, you know, known ne'er-do-wells, or on the bargaining committee. None of us on the bargaining committee were offered jobs.
Okay.
And yet, excepting myself, who did have one of the higher merit pays because the guild contract always permitted management to pay above scale to certain staff, and the union had to see it, you know, so it wasn't. And so I was recognized, but I wasn't hired. The best sports guy, as far as editing and everything, he wasn't hired. Was our state editor hired? You know, so there were a lot of good journalists that were. There were four of the five bargaining committee were journalist people, and none of us got job offers.
Uh-huh.
So then I ended up, after 18 months working for a Catholic magazine, being offered a job as a representative for the State County Municipal Employees here in Milwaukee, which I took that for 4 years. At the time, we had the brand new collective bargaining law, and I bargained a couple of first labor contracts in the history of Milwaukee. So those are, you know, exciting times. I went to work for the National Union of the AIW in 1968.
What was the Catholic magazine you worked for before AFSCME?
Well, that was Country Beautiful.
Hmm.
It's no longer in business. Country Beautiful was published by the National Catholic Rural Life Conference.
Okay.
Well, actually, that was one of its sponsors. It was an independent nonprofit organization, which we had significant support, believe it or not, from Sears Roebuck.
Funny.
Because the priest who came from the National Catholic Rural Life Conference, Father Deneen, a very progressive liberal guy as far as his politics goes, but probably the most dishonest man I ever worked with. But don't put that in the notes.
Very okay. Funny. Couple quick questions, and then let's sign off for today.
Gotcha.
This has been great fun. As I mentioned, I haven't listened to your and Gordon's interview yet. Did you discuss, I assume you did, the strike and the guild work?
Oh, I sure did, yeah.
Okay. Did you talk about the AFSCME time, or?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you talk about the Labor History Society?
I doubt it.
Okay.
I may have done that a little bit.
That's
well,
great.
Actually, you can read it.
I will, but I just wanted to double check. So that's good. I won't repeat asking you some guild stuff that's in there.
But you ought to, you know, run through it in its written form.
Yeah.
John, have you got that link?
I have the link for the written form. I don't have an audio yet. Correct.
Right. No, you don't have an audio. We don't have that online, but I do have my transcript,
yeah.
which if you don't have the link, let me know and I'll send it to you.
Okay. And as I've said other times, I still do not have a copy of the Lansing Les Washburn interview you did. And that would be wonderful to connect to this also.
I've only got the transcript. I don't have the audio.
And you believe Fine still does?
Well, she gave it to somebody. I forget my last conversation.
Okay.
She was going to follow through with it. She gave me a contact. That got buried with everything else.
So in the list of AIW innovations, this may have preceded your time, but one of the other things that I knew AIW for being somewhat famous because I was doing programs with some AIW locals on the west side of the state, and also because Bob Ripas wrote an article about it way back in the 60s, was the fact that AIW went for quite a while without arbitration as the last step in some of its grievance procedures.
Well, there was a... Oh, yeah. I mean, that early on.
Right.
You know, I thought that was also a policy of the CIO group, too.
Okay. So I want to... I'll look into that, but I might ask you some about that, because that's kind of famous, I think.
Well, I do not really have much firsthand knowledge.
Okay, fine. Okay. And then the other thing is, do you still have a blank copy of the release form? Or I'll forward you one.
I gave you.
I need a new one for today.
Okay. I thought that covered everything.
No, I don't think they'll let me do that here.
Okay, whatever you...
Okay. So, we'll be getting together again, and this was wonderful. I hope you had fun, too.
Oh, sure. I always talk about myself.
Great fun. So, are you all set for Thanksgiving, or are you just too busy with your society work to get ready for any things like that?
Not for my wife.
Good. You take care. Have a great...
You guys have a good Thanksgiving if we don't talk before
that. Take care, Ken. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.